Okay, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of people in Wisconsin aren't ready for retirement. We'll check out the recommendations from a new task force looking at ways to make saving money easier for people of all ages. First, Congress continues its investigation into the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6th with multiple hearings and witnesses from various law enforcement agencies. And senators are getting their first cracks at President Biden's coronavirus relief and economic recovery bill. It's the week in Washington where we take a closer look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what different law enforcement groups knew going into January 6th, how they responded, how quickly they responded? Have you been following these hearings? What has stood out to you? What do you want to know more about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, good to be with you.
I know you're following both chambers as they review January 6th. Scott, who are we hearing from this week?
Well, today we had hearings in both the House and the Senate concurrently on the January 6th attacks on the Capitol. And as you just heard, we had Major General William Walker testify from the D.C. National Guard. He's the top official for the National Guard in Washington, D.C., who testified that there was a frantic call that came in from the Capitol Police Chief on January 6th, and that it took more than 3 hours, 3 hours and 19 minutes to be exact, before he got approval from top Pentagon officials who needed to sign off on sending the National Guard to the Capitol, even though there were dozens of his troops on buses ready to go engage in the battle that was already underway in the Capitol. He needed that sign off, and it took more than 3 hours. And as we know now, there were dozens and dozens of injuries to Capitol police officers during that time. And of course, five people died in the fighting and some of the related incidents. So we are learning more and more details as we speak, more and more details. The pieces are slowly falling into place. And then on the House side of things, Rob, we heard from the Capitol Police Chief, the acting Capitol Police Chief, Pittman, who testified a more urgent threat to the Capitol. She told lawmakers today that they are on high alert this week because of information and intelligence they're getting that a militia group known as the Three Percenters is looking to breach the Capitol again as soon as tomorrow, March 4th. March 4th is significant in the QAnon conspiracy theory because that's the day when they believe, QAnon believers, that former President Trump will be inaugurated again. Of course, we know that's not going to happen, but in this conspiracy theory, this is what they think is going to happen. There's a concern among lawmakers and law enforcement that there could be another attempt to breach the Capitol sometime tomorrow.
Let's give a listen to General William Walker, commander of the D.C. National Guard, talking about the urgency of the call he got that you mentioned. Here's a listen.
At 1:49 p.m., I received a frantic call from then Chief of United States Capitol Police, Stephen Sun, where he informed me that the security perimeter of the United States Capitol had been breached by hostile rioters. Chief Sun, his voice cracking with emotion, indicated that there was a dire emergency at the Capitol, and he requested the immediate assistance of as many available National Guardsmen that I could muster.
And that open questions remain about that timeline. I understand some in the Pentagon have disputed that timeline, the three-hour delay. What does that open up about who members of Congress want to hear from next to try to get to the bottom of that, Scott?
Well, that's exactly right. Pentagon officials are refuting General Walker's account, which is something you don't necessarily see too often in the chain of command, where you have a subordinate officer questioning the actions of the higher ups. But their argument from the top of Pentagon officials, their argument was that they had approved the request for National Guard aid quickly in about an hour's time, which doesn't match up with Walker's account. They also point out that They had made the National Guard available to Capitol Police and other law enforcement in the days in advance of the January 6th attack, but were turned down. So there's a lot of contradictions in all of these statements from various officials, even within the Pentagon itself. Now, I think it's interesting that Walker feels empowered to criticize some of his former bosses, because a lot of those people are no longer at the Pentagon anymore. They served under President Trump. There's a new team in place now serving under President Biden. And so Walker may feel a little bit more liberated to criticize the top brass at the Pentagon than he would had some of those individuals remained in place.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Milwaukee. Joe, hello. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, what did you want to say, Joe?
I wanted to say that in his last, month in office, Trump fired people in the Pentagon and put in, completely bizarre cronies to head the, very powerful seats at the Pentagon. And these people were in the decision-making chain, as was apparently the brother of I forget the name, Flynn, General Flynn. And I'm not really hearing anybody talking about, these people's complicity in this lack of decision making at this critical time.
Joe, thanks for the call. And Scott, yeah, the president had dismissed his defense secretary. There was an acting defense secretary in place, and in many ways at the top of this chain of command. What are people looking at the roles that some of those late appointees may have made on January 6th and in the run up to it?
Certainly. We heard from both Democratic and Republican senators today that they want to hear from some of these people who were in decision-making roles at the Pentagon, acting Secretary of Defense at the time, Christopher Miller, as well as Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy, both Trump officials. For Miller, he served after Mark Esper and very late in the game in terms of the Trump presidency. And so these are additional people that members of Congress of both parties want to haul before their committees and hear directly from their mouths what had happened and what had transpired in those three hours and 20 minutes after that frantic call was made by the Capitol Police Chief.
Thanks for the call, Joe. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics this week. Scott, Congress also heard from FBI Director Christopher Wray. He talked about the intelligence the FBI did and didn't have leading up to January 6th and about claims, including from some on the Senate floor, misleading claims on who was involved in that Capitol riot. What were some of the key things we heard from the FBI director?
Well, number one, that he addressed some of the concerns about the security and intelligence breakdowns that had to do with the FBI Norfolk office in Virginia. This is the office that sent out a bulletin the night before the attack, warning of potential violence at the Capitol on January 6th. They were picking up chatter in some of those circles of that there was going to be war at the Capitol, if you remember. And the FBI in previous weeks had been faulted for merely sending an email in the dead of night that apparently didn't get picked up by any of the associated law enforcement agencies. But Director Christopher Wray pushed back during a Senate hearing earlier this week, saying the FBI actually had communicated that message to its law enforcement partners in three different ways: on email, through their law enforcement portal, which is connected to all the various agencies, something that was set up in the wake of 9/11 when there were complaints that there wasn't communication between the agencies. And also, he says they followed up by phone call. So at some point along the line, the ball was dropped. It's still unclear who exactly dropped the ball, but according to Wray, they reached out and sent that message, a warning of a potential violence, three different ways. He also made clear that this was, he's not mincing words, he's calling this domestic terror. And so he wanted to be clear. I know there was some dispute about what exactly you call this attack, since it was carried out and perpetrated by Americans. He made clear, number one, that this was a domestic terrorist attack intended to cause harm or to intimidate members of Congress in the process of carrying out their democratic duties. And he also made clear that he was questioned directly of whether, you know, Antifa was behind this. He made clear that, that did not appear to be the case at all. There's some dispute. Republicans certainly are trying to muddy the waters in that regard. But I think he was very clear that the violence, the most heinous acts were carried out by some of these militia groups. A lot of them are right-wing militia groups, and certainly there appeared to be, in many cases, this was a coordinated attempt, and they have a lot of evidence pointing to that as well. So those were some of the key points that we heard from Director Ray.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's the week in Washington. We're talking about more congressional hearings looking at January 6th and coming up, the U.S. Senate now taking up the COVID relief and economic recovery bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The bill passed the House. It is before the Senate now. The minimum wage increase is out of it for now. Do you think Democrats should push to try to bring it back through potentially by Senate standards, extreme measures, or are you okay with that not being in there? Dialing back some of the checks, lowering the threshold where the checks' direct payments to people go down, some efforts to slow things down by Republicans in the Senate. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's our look at the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we turn to the new COVID-19 economic relief package now before the Senate. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, Scott, this thing is through the House on the road to this reconciliation procedure that just requires a majority or 50 plus a vice president in this case. But some changes already, including that threshold for who gets direct payments. What is changing now in the Senate?
Yeah, Rob, that was the big development today, was this deal between Joe Biden and the Senate Democrats. They tweaked the threshold, the income level requirements to qualify for these $1,400 stimulus checks. The change is that it's now $75,000 per individuals per year, or for couples, $150,000 per year. Those people who make that salary will still receive the full $1,400 stimulus check. There's also, they changed the way that the money is phased out. So people who make now $80,000 per year, anything above $80,000 per year, they will not be receiving a check. The House bill had put that number up at $100,000 salary per year. And so it restricts the amount of people who will be eligible to receive a stimulus check. That's the bottom line. Progressives obviously had wanted the most amount of people to get these checks. They are saying that they're disappointed. People like, Pramila Jayapal and Mark Pocan, progressive leaders, they are saying they're disappointed, but it doesn't look like it's going to be a deal breaker. It doesn't look like, they're going to lose Democratic votes because of some of these tweaks. And so the bottom line is Democrats know that they want to get this victory. They want to hand Joe Biden the first legislative victory of his presidency. They understand that the need is great. They understand they want to push this money out into the community. And so, at the end of the day, they will get there. We're still winding through this legislative process. And right now we're just at the start of it in the Senate. It's going to be a number of days where it's going to work its way through the amendment process in the Senate. And then next week, they're going to kick it back over to the House, where I am right now. And they'll have to take it up once again in the House before they send it on to Joe Biden's desk.
Let's bring on a caller on this at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in northern Wisconsin. Kevin, hello.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, just, you know, as far as the stimulus checks, you know, maybe there can be changes on as far as the income limits. But, you know, when you're making $20,000-$30,000 a year, okay, say you need tires for your vehicle, okay, or you got another repair. I mean, that stuff's really expensive nowadays. Or say your refrigerator goes out on you, okay, you got $1,000 in the bank or with you to take care of that. You know what's wrong? I don't think there's anything wrong with it. So, because I'm on a fixed income and I've received the stimulus checks. And I was quite accustomed to living on a fixed income, but it's nice to have a couple extra dollars in the bank and on my person.
Kevin, thanks a lot for calling in. And Scott, we've heard a lot from callers, some saying, yes, this stimulus check is a lifesaver for me, or at least a big difference maker. Some people maybe hovering around that level where people are saying that's where the threshold should be, saying, yeah, I don't really need the check. It seems like there's a lot of general agreement that checks for at least some Americans might be a good idea. It's just a matter of where that threshold is.
Yeah, and I think that, Democrats realize that this is just a Band-Aid, and that, you know, there are so many millions of Americans who are impacted by the COVID crisis. Here we are a year later, and Congress has already passed, three big packages. Here's yet another package, and this one will rival that initial package they did at the start of the crisis last year. But you know, the talk in Democratic circles right now is that this is just the start, and the next step after they pass this COVID bill next week will be some kind of jobs bill. So, you know, first they're throwing aid at the problem in terms of, you know, testing and vaccines and monies for school and monies for state and local governments, as well as these checks for people and unemployment insurance money. And then the next step after that will be some kind of jobs bill. And the thing that people are most talking about up here is infrastructure. And so I think after the COVID relief bill, you're going to see this pivot towards infrastructure, and there's going to be a whole nother debate over that, specifically whether it can be a bipartisan, pursuit, or if, again, you know, it's going to be something like we're seeing with this COVID package, which is very partisan. It's going to pass basically on party lines. Not a single Republican in the House supported it last week. We are anticipating either zero or perhaps one Republican could endorse it in the Senate. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who said today she's still on the fence. But that has been the criticism of Republicans, is that there's not enough of reaching across the aisle to get Republicans on board this thing. That'll be a big question for the infrastructure package in the next round, whether or not that will be something that will be bipartisan.
Let's go back to our callers. Steve is with us in Stevens Point. Steve, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. If you could you comment on why this bill is being called a COVID relief bill when 90% of it has nothing to do with COVID relief? Only 10% of this bill goes directly to COVID relief. You would get a lot more bipartisan support if this bill wasn't quite structured the way it is. If you could comment on that, I'd certainly appreciate it and like to hear what you have to say.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. This is another criticism from Republicans in particular. Some of this is directly for vaccines and treating disease. Some of it's for economic relief related to COVID. And then it kind of gets blurry from there. Where do you see the line drawn there, Scott?
Yeah, I'm not sure where the caller's getting the 90% percent versus 10% number. What Democrats have said, this is going to focus on specific things having to do with COVID, meaning vaccine, more money for vaccines, more money for testing, also things like, you know, and then peripheral things like how to get kids back in schools, which is indirectly related to COVID, in terms of air filtration systems, increasing the you know, the air quality in classrooms. They're saying that is all related to COVID. You have the, as we mentioned before, the direct checks and the stimulus payments. You have, they are keeping in the Senate bill the $400 per week in enhanced unemployment benefits. It looks like the Senate wants to keep those enhanced benefits through the month of August. And so that is very similar to what we saw in the House. There had been some discussion that they were going to try to pare that back, but it looks like they're going to be able to preserve it at that level. The big Republican criticism had been focused on this idea of some transportation projects, specifically in New York, and then the one I'm more familiar with coming from the San Francisco Bay Area, which is the BART train extension to San Jose. There had been $100 million set aside or earmarked for that. Republicans have said that was, that was a Nancy Pelosi earmark that was inserted in this bill. Apparently, that has been stripped out of it after the Republican criticism. Republicans are celebrating that move, as well as a stripping out of another transportation project in New York. So there is some valid criticism that there were some extraneous issues in there. But in terms of the grand scheme of things, those were very, very minor dollar figures compared to the nearly $2 trillion package that is this coronavirus relief bill.
And it looks like, Scott, the 10% is roughly the public health part of this, the vaccines and PPE and things like this, that are, of course, is a COVID economic relief package mainly. So I think that's where that 10% is out there.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
That's all the time we have, Scott. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Oh, sure. Anytime, Rob. Thank you.
That's Scott Wong. He covers House leadership as a senior staff writer at The Hill. We talked to him today for a look at the week in Washington, looking at the latest developments around the Senate and President Biden's COVID bill. Coming up after the news, many people in Wisconsin and around the U.S. don't have a lot of money saved for retirement. We'll check out a new state plan aimed at boosting retirement savings and security and what it could mean for you. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, you might have heard about new genetic variations in the virus that causes COVID-19. Find out how the state uses genetic sampling to keep tabs on the changing virus. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, nearly a million Wisconsinites don't have access to retirement saving through their employer. A state retirement task force came out with recommendations last month for how to make retirement more accessible for Wisconsinites. The recommendations include creating savings accounts for every person born in the state that could ultimately be used for retirement. Sarah Godlewski is the Wisconsin State Treasurer and the chair of the Bipartisan Retirement Task Force. Godlewski is a Democrat. She joined us earlier today to talk about the Retirement Task Force recommendations. What are some of the challenges people in Wisconsin are having when it comes to saving for a secure retirement?
Well, first, I want to define the problem, Rob, because a lot of people know retirement security is a concern, but truly, it is a crisis. We know that 88% of Wisconsinites are concerned about their financial security and wish they could save more. And when you look at the numbers, by allowing the status quo to continue, we're going to see over 400,000 seniors in poverty by 2030. And that's going to come at a cost to the state. By not taking any action, we'll see over $3 billion to our state budget. And the system is complicated. People can't live off of Social Security alone, and they don't have access to retirement at work. We know almost a million Wisconsinites don't have retirement at work. And these are the issues that our task force looked at head on, whether it was access to increasing participation.
You mentioned that retirement task force. You're the chair of that. What are the recommendations you released to help address this problem?
So there were five recommendations, and it was looking not only at the current system and how we can improve it, but where are the gaps? And we wanted to make sure that these were innovative, bipartisan solutions, but also that they were financially sustainable. And so there's two that I want to highlight just on the front end. The first is 401 kids. Something that we kept hearing over and over again is that I wish I would have saved early. And so 401 kids opens an account the day somebody is born. It feeds the account with whether that's $100, $200, and it allows it to grow. And so for an example, if we would seed that account with $500, and we allow the market to work for it just the way that a 401k or Roth IRA does, that account would be worth over $40,000 by the time that Wisconsinite turns 65, which could be an incredible difference for so many families across the state. And then the second recommendation, Rob, is looking at our small business solution. It's called Wisconsin Saves, and you can think about it more or less as a public option. We heard from small business owners that it's not that they don't want to offer retirement. It's more that it's either too costly, too complicated, or too time consuming. And so the state would set up a retirement option that employers could join at no cost, and workers could use it as well at no cost, and they're immediately vested. And that would get to what we have been told a really big problem when it comes to access.
Now, how about people who are a little older, a little further along, might be retiring in the next, or hoping to retire, I should say, in the next 10 years, who will be part of that number you mentioned by 2030, so many people living in poverty? Are there things that you can help do to help those people in the short run?
Well, something that we looked at in talking to people who are about to retire is it's never too late to open up a retirement account and save. And something that we found out is even by starting to save in your 50s, you can make up that difference in the next 15 years. And so that's really what it became a conversation about, is how can we provide access to retirement plans? So even if it's $10, $15, $20, saving something at any point in your life is better than not saving at all.
And what kind of things can be done to help incentivize that, make it easier for that person, again, looking at that hopeful retirement date sooner rather than later?
Well, you mentioned incentives, Robin. That's actually one recommendation that we provide in the task force. But with regard to auto enrollment, right now when you start a company and they offer you retirement, you're trying to figure out, okay, what do I sign up for between retirement, healthcare, starting my job? And we know when businesses automatically enroll people into a retirement plan, they are 90% more likely to start saving. And so that is one of the recommendations, is incentivizing companies to, rather than having their employees opt in, they can actually opt out and be included the day that they start their job in saving for retirement.
A common theme I'm hearing from you and the committee and elsewhere is, you know, a really complicated system where you have to do all kinds of shopping around and comparing apples and oranges doesn't necessarily help a lot of people. The more you can do to simplify and kind of automate retirement savings, the more difference you're going to make. Is that a fair assessment of the philosophy of a lot of these ideas?
That is spot on. We know the more we can make this easy for employees and workers, the best chance they are to not only save, but to save more in the long run. And one of the other recommendations that we have put forth is an e-commerce platform. And the idea is that the state would have a one-stop shop for information, where whether you are an employer trying to figure out how to offer retirement, or you are a worker trying to figure out how to make the best decisions, you can find that information in one spot. But with regards to just automatic enrollment, Rob, I do want to add that we know when you are offered a plan at work, you are 15 times more likely to save, which again is why we continue to emphasize the need for a small business solution.
As we wrap up, these are task force recommendations. What is the road to go from those recommendations to some of these things actually becoming policy?
We are looking at two tracks. The first is the governor did include the small business solution, Wisconsin Saves, and 401 kids in the budget. And then one of our task force, as I mentioned from the front end, was a bipartisan task force. We had legislators from both sides of the aisle, and working with them to pass this through committees. One of the participants was Representative Mako, who chairs the Ways and Means Committee, and working on how exactly we can best package that to make sure that goes through his committee. And so we are rolling up our sleeves, building this coalition, but we have great support, whether it's from the legislature to the governor and citizens across the state.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Wisconsin State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. She joined us earlier today for a look at recommendations from a state task force on retirement savings. Coming up, we'll talk to a UW expert on retirement savings and public policy, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about some of those ideas we just heard about? What is your biggest worry about retirement? If you are an employer, are you looking for ways to make it easier for your employees to save for retirement? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about retirement savings in Wisconsin. Most Americans are not saving enough to retire at their current standard of living by age 65. About 40% of Americans face the possibility of poverty in retirement, according to a 2018 study by the New School. A UW study found that more than 400,000 senior citizens in Wisconsin could be living in poverty by 2030. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes, maybe a policy change, that would make it easier for you to save for retirement? Do you have questions about how all this works? Join in at 800-642-1234. J. Michael Collins is faculty director of the Center for Financial Security and a professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Well, we just talked to State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski about this retirement task force, which you, I believe, were also on. What stands out to you about the urgency of this problem of retirement security?
You know, it was an honor to be part of the task force, and I really, you know, thank the governor and the treasurer for convening this bipartisan effort. You know, we did, as part of this task force, we had a number of meetings around the state and listened to, you know, individuals talk about their the retired individuals and talked about how they got to that point, or people who were trying to save up for retirement. And it just strikes me how much anxiety people feel about saving for retirement. That, you know, some got lucky, they worked for an employer that had a good plan. Some, you know, didn't. And so, you know, they're feeling like they're not ready. And, you know, I was also struck by the fact that there was a lot of optimism. You know, there wasn't a lot of policy disagreement among committee members. I think there's a strong sense of, you know, we can provide better systems and better programs for people in the state so that they get to retirement feeling a lot more secure.
One thing that I didn't get to with the state treasurer is actually something I've talked to you about in the past, Michael. People not having emergency savings right now for that $300 car repair or $500 home or furnace repair, what have you. And if people are in that situation and they, you know, can't afford something that might happen next week, it seems like it'd be really hard to prioritize saving for retirement maybe decades away. How do we bridge that gap?
Yeah, it's a great point. And, you know, there is definitely sort of a hierarchy of needs when it comes to personal finances. And, you know, when I'm worried about being able to get a car repair or refrigerator repair, then, you know, saving for something that's going to happen 40 years from now becomes really low priority. So I think, you know, we also saw the committee began back in 2019, well before the pandemic, but we saw in the COVID pandemic, a lot of people who use their retirement accounts as that form of emergency savings. So, you know, both the lack of emergency savings discourages people from being able to start a retirement. And then, you know, when an emergency hits, if they start using their longer term retirement funds for an emergency, that also saps those funds. So there's definitely a strong complementarity between encouraging people to save for those, plan for and save for those short term things, as well as being ready to prepare for those longer term things. And I think, you know, partly the report tries to address that with some, you know, building in some emergency savings features to savings accounts so that people can both save for retirement and have a protection for emergencies. But it's very true. We have to sort of be thinking holistically about retirement planning and overall financial security.
Talking to J. Michael Collins, Faculty Director of the Center for Financial Security at UW-Madison, looking at retirement in Wisconsin, the difficulty people have saving for retirement, and recommendations from a task force to help people do that. A lot of this would come through the state legislature if these recommendations are pursued. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Yordis joins us now in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I had an idea that all Social Security recipients should have a minimum amount that they receive, like $1,000 a month, because there's so many people that there's interruptions in their work life. For instance, my sister's husband had cancer. She was taking care of him full time. And after he passed, her son had a car accident, which caused her to need to constantly take them to different appointments and therapies, and this completely interrupted her being able to make a living. And now at her age, over 65, she is working, and I mean, it's just really, really hard because she has a child that needs help, and there are many, many stories like that. And in rural places, people's wages are so low that you know, and farmers, you know, all kinds of people really, they work very hard. And when they get to retirement, the amount they get back from the government is very low.
Yordis, thanks a lot for the call. Yordis referring, Michael, I think, to Social Security benefits being based on your income and if your income is interrupted or low to begin with. Can you talk about Social Security as part of this picture?
Yeah, no, it's really important. I mean, we oftentimes use this metaphor in retirement planning of a three-legged stool. And so one of those legs is Social Security, the Social Security benefits, which is, you know, it's an annuity that you can get for the rest of your life once you claim it for the old age component of Social Security. And it's been a critical part of people's financial security, you know, including people for retirement, but also for disability and for survivors, for widowed survivors. You know, there are a number of issues the caller raised, I think, that are really worth focusing on. I think we, you know, we have designed Social Security to be a system where you pay in when you work. And so typically we're looking for people who've worked for 10 years, you know, repeatedly. So they look for these, you know, credits that you have towards contributing. And then the amount you get is in part based on how much you put in. And so the less you put in, the fewer years you have in, the less you're going to get out at the end. There is some redistribution that is built into the system. So there are some minimum levels, but as the caller said, it's really not enough to get people by. I think there are a few things that the caller raised too that are worth thinking about too. Women oftentimes bear the brunt of this. They oftentimes are the ones who are the caregivers and who have, you know, for other reasons, not been in the workforce as much. And so, you know, oftentimes it puts them in a position where they have, and by the way, they oftentimes outlive their spouse, their male spouse. So, you know, I think that's an issue where women sometimes really have an extra layer of difficulty to face these issues. Same kinds of issues with people in agriculture or maybe who aren't part of that pay-in system, the FICA tax system. And so, you know, we definitely have people for whom the system hasn't worked well. There have been some proposals to better, you know, compensate or allocate benefits for people who have been documented caregivers. And so that caregiving might be for, you know, a family member or somebody else. And so I think there are some, it's still really early in that policy development process, but there are some proposals to better deal with those kinds of issues because we recognize that is a, you know, is an important role that people play. They're not able to earn, but we do want to not penalize them for taking that task on. And certainly if the alternative is that they, you know, have that task taken care of by the state or by the public, we'd prefer people do that on their own than have to turn to public sources to do it.
Thanks for the call, Yordis. We'll go to Cindy now in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Hello. Well, this makes the great case for a union. I was union employed for 21 years and retired with a pension. So with the pension, my Social Security, and my 401k, I will be okay. And I think it's really time to look at bringing unions back because people then come out with a pension and it helps you survive when you're retired.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Michael, can you talk about the change, a decline in unions, and I think a decline in the availability of pensions in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's two different issues. There's the issue of sort of unions and the ability of workers to organize and really advocate for the best benefits they can get. And then there's the issue of pensions, which are, you know, like this kind of defined benefit that you get by paying in. You know, a lot of companies have moved away from pensions, you know, in part because of the, you know, the financial issues involved in that and also the demographic issues and others. And so, you know, I think most companies now, most large companies have moved to more of a defined contribution plan where you're putting in a 401k and not a pension. So we've seen a big movement away from pensions, and that's both within unionized and non-unionized companies. I think one of the bigger issues that we face with both unions and pensions and retirement plans in general is who you work for makes a big difference. And so if you work for a larger company, whether it's unionized or not, you're probably going to get better benefits. If you work for a small business or you're self-employed, your ability to even find benefits is really limited. And I think the treasurer made comments about this. It's just tough for a small business to walk into whether it's an insurance company or a financial services company and get a good deal. The kinds of retirement plans that they get offered tend to have high fees. You know, these plans aren't designed really with the consumer in mind. And so, you know, it's rational for some small businesses to say, look, I can't really provide my employees something that's good here. And the best way to get around that is to get to some scale. And that's partly what this Wisconsin SAFE proposal tries to do, is pull together lots of employers, small employers, and lots of individuals to, you know, get that buying power, to get a better plan with better quality investment options and lower fees. So, you know, in some ways it replicates what unions do for within a company, but within the state, and allows people to band together and hopefully get a better deal for their benefit.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. We'll go to Gail now in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The one thing I have a concern about is that there are private money management firms that are trying to get a hold of these accounts so that they can charge fees and for their services and service charges and whatever extra money they can start to pull out of each one of those personal accounts that would be brought in to the one umbrella account that would be making all the money, like the 401k groups all together that corporations have. Moving it over to this money management firm would just start to nickel and dime and dollar away all out of the profits that
Gail,
should be going.
I'm going to jump in, Gail. We're just about out of time. Briefly, Michael, Gail's concern.
She's 100% right. We spent a lot of our time on the task force talking about this very issue. And part of the idea is to have some supervision by the state, by an advisory committee that would have a duty on behalf of the participants to get the best deal possible and not let those fees and costs get chiseled away, because we recognize that's a really big threat to people's financial security.
Thanks for that call. In our last few moments, Michael, I mean, we have task forces in Wisconsin sometime. We have recommendations. Did you get a feeling that people felt a sense of urgency that at least some of these recommendations were going to lead to policy changes?
You know, I'm pretty optimistic. I do feel like this is going somewhere, and in part because this isn't requiring a big public outlay of resources. It's really thinking about ways in the long run to save the state money. So this is a good example of the state sort of doing something now that will potentially have long run benefits down the line.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was J. Michael Collins, faculty director of the Center for Financial Security and professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us for a look at retirement savings in the state. Earlier, we heard from State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski, who's chair of a state task force on retirement. That task force, which J. Michael Collins is also on, came out with recent recommendations. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin's expungement system to remove people's criminal records is due for an overhaul. That's according to our guests who make the case for reform. Author and essayist Anne Lamott joins the show to share stories of courage and revival from her new book, Dusk, Night, Dawn. And more schools are bringing students, staff, and teachers back into their buildings. We'll find out how they're adapting after months of virtual learning. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. A couple months back, I told you about the Snowplows of Scotland getting fun individual names. The names were picked by the public in a big contest. And I made the case that we could do something like that here in Wisconsin. Well, just this week, a certain upper Midwest state announced their contest winners to do just that. But it wasn't Wisconsin. It was Minnesota. Our neighbors to the west held a contest to name eight of their snowplows, one in each plowing district, or however that works. 50 finalists were chosen from over 24,000 entries. Here are the winning names. There's, of course, Plowy McPlowface. I don't think you can do a public naming contest without blank McBlankface anymore. And there was Duck Duck Orange Truck. That's one for the kids. There are a couple of Star Wars ones made the final cut. There would be Snoby Wan Kenobi and Darth Blader. And then there were some Minnesota-specific ones. I like this. Plow Bunyan. We share that legend, Wisconsin and Minnesota, the Paul Bunyan legend. F. Salt Fitzgerald. And I didn't know F. Scott Fitzgerald, the author, was born in St. Paul. That was news to me. The Plow, formerly known as Plow, reference to Prince, of course, with strong Minneapolis roots. And in Minnesotaese and Wisconsinese. Oh, just got a plow right past you. All right, we could do this, Wisconsin, right? Can't we? We can get together on this, name our own plows. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. President Biden says states like Texas and Mississippi are making a big mistake by ending their mask mandates. NPR's Issa Roscoe reports